and welcome to Liberating Libraries, a podcast by the Conspiracy of Equality. My name is Caitlin.
And my name is Blake. And if you'd like to know more about Liberating Libraries and the project, you can check us out at our website, liberatinglibraries.org, or check us out on Instagram at Liberating Libraries. Mm-hmm. So, what is the topic we're going to be discussing today?
Yeah, so today we're taking a look at some fiction that has to do with fascism. Topical.
Very topical and a little depressing.
A little depressing. But why don't we explain a little bit about our thinking on the books that we chose. So today we're looking at two books. One is a graphic novel. It's actually a three-part graphic novel called Berlin, written by Jason Lutz, that was published last year. I think the final one was put out this year.
Yes.
Yeah. So very recent graphic novel called Berlin that looks at basically the city of Berlin, stories woven through the city of Berlin pre the sort of rise of the Third Reich and Hitler. Yeah. So looking at the buildup towards...
It was what, 28, 29, and 30, I believe. Yeah. Those are the 3 years that they look at.
And the second book is actually a memoir, sort of, by Natalia Ginzburg, called Family Lexicon.
Yes, so Natalia is Italian and grew up in Italy through the rise of Mussolini and through World War II. So it is a memoir of hers, and she talks about how she couldn't fictionalize it. She felt that she was drawn and forced to write it as it actually happened, which is a little different. However, it's done in a very literary way. So it reads like a novel and it reads like literary fiction, even though it is like her true memories of kind of the 30s and into the early 40s.
Yeah, I think she says in her foreword that she both doesn't, like what you're saying, like didn't want any of it to be fictionalized, want it to be a true account of her memories, but that she also wants it to be read like a novel. Yeah. And she is a, from what I understand, a fairly well-known Italian author. And this book was written, I think, first in 1960, but it actually wasn't translated. It seems like the first translation into English was fairly recently.
Yeah, so it was first written in 63, and it wasn't translated until 2017. And this is the only kind of translation that, like, the only... for English version that exists. But the book is, so it's broadly about her and her very unique and quirky family and the ways in which they relate to each other during kind of the rise of Mussolini and the rise of fascism and the drumbeat towards war.
Yeah, and it's also important that her family is like vehemently anti-fascist.
Yes.
And they're also all very involved in anti-fascist organizing and in organizing against Mussolini. She herself was married to someone who was involved in the organizing. She was in prison. He was in prison as well, and he later died. She's very much in the heart of that branch of Italian anti-fascism that came out of, I think, like educated middle class leftist folks in Italy at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're both a little bit different in terms of their structure and like they're not novels in the traditional sense. I mean, like graphic novels we haven't really done on this show before and we haven't talked about them and neither of us have read that many graphic novels.
Not at all.
Do you have anything to say about graphic novels?
I really enjoyed reading Berlin. I think you're right. Like, I haven't read many graphic novels, and the ones that I have read have been not even necessarily fictional stories. They've been, like, very much true, like, historical accounts. I'm thinking, like, Red Rosa and 1919 and the Graphic History Collective kind of work. So, like, it's, like, graphicizing historical moments. So, like, I think this might have been... my second, because there's Persepolis as well. But, like, they are different to read. Like, I really enjoyed reading it. It's interesting because you're reading the dialogue, but then, like, you have this beautiful artwork that you need to look at to kind of grasp, like the tone and, like, what's happening. And, like, so you're getting this really complete picture out of like these little bubbles. And the artwork in Berlin is really quite beautiful, like mm-hmm. really, really good artwork. Yeah, so it's just like it's a different way of reading, because like you can read it really fast and you can read it almost too fast because you're not taking in enough of the artwork. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to slow yourself down and like appreciate kind of what the drawings are, like especially when there are sections that are just like action sequences, so there's actually no dialogue in it, or like you really need to like slow yourself down and put yourself in these pictures that you're seeing, which is a very different way of reading than what you're used to, but it is very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with all of that. Yeah, I found myself periodically needing to remind myself to slow down and to look at the pictures of the action, because I think we're very used to reading novels where whole paragraphs will be about setting up that tone and that description and doing all that character work. And actually in a graphic novel, all this character work is happening in the yeah. drawings. And that's just a really different mm-hmm. way of reading. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason that we chose these two, I mean, we actually spent quite a bit of time going through, like, looking for books that would allow us to talk about fascism as it appears in fiction, and in very particularly talking about fascism in its historical form.
Yeah.
Because I think one thing we both talked about was that there is a fair amount of writing about sort of dystopian versions of fascism, or sort of projections of what a future under fascism might look like. And we could have chosen books like that and talked about their relevance for today, mm-hmm. but we wanted instead to find books that were about actual experiences of fascism in history. And that was a harder project than I think either of us thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it was even more difficult because we were trying to be even more specific of like finding books about fascism in its early stages, mm. right? Because there is so much written about like World War II fiction. Like there's tons of it out there. But like, I don't know, like I think for me, and I think for you as well, we were both interested in being like, what was going on in the 1920s in Berlin, right? Like what was happening? How were people into thinking about and seeing the rise of, you know, the Nazis?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it actually was very difficult, and there was not a lot out there that looked good.
Mm-hmm. And I think we really lucked out with Berlin, I think, because yeah. Berlin hit all of those markers in terms yeah. of what it was and some of the purpose that I think the author had behind putting it together. Because, of course, part of the reason that we're doing this and part of the reason we're talking about fascism in fiction is because this is the moment that we're experiencing and that we're feeling. And mm-hmm. the idea of wanting to know and see what it felt like and looked like for people in this sort of uncertainty and rise of these forces is kind of like, it's super important to understanding and thinking about our own feelings in the current moment.
Yeah. Like, so I just, so in our city that we live in, there have been, over the course of a year, active far right and fascist organizations who have been organizing, who have been holding rallies, who have attacked Pride. And it's just like, it seems to have happened so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost, it kept feeling more and more unbelievable. So it's just like, I remember being like, I just felt so lost at one point, being like, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel right now. Like how, like what, like how am I supposed to feel right now about everything happening? And right, like I think for both of us, like, go to fiction, right? Like go find something to read that can help you understand the moment, that can help you process your feelings and your emotions. And there just hadn't been anything. So I think like that's kind of where it came from, where it's just like there was a real desire to be like, okay, how do we feel?
Mm-hmm.
And like how do we kind of like help this, help use fiction to help us try to like move forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And like thinking like exactly what you're saying, like the focus on feelings, I think, is a really big thing that we're hoping that folks can take from our discussion, is not just thinking about trying to figure out fascism in an analytical sense or like in a historical sense, but actually like what it feels like to live with with creeping fascism and what it feels like to struggle against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think the first thing that we wanted to look at was, you know, like what kinds of stories are being told in these two books? Because they're both dealing with quite a lot and actually quite a lot of historical time. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference between the books that struck me was the difference between sort of the rapid transformations and change that you see in Berlin and the kind of like holding on to family and to like and onto language that you see in family lexicon. Yeah. So I know that you have some thoughts on Berlin specifically around the main character, Martha.
Yeah, she is the central character. So the book starts off kind of following her journey into Berlin. So she is from the countryside. She's older. She's going to attend art school because she's a very good artist. And yeah, so the story kind of shows her development and her kind of rejection of art school and kind of like the things that she was learning just weren't appealing to her. Her kind of resistance against her parents who really don't want her in Berlin and are really horrified when she leaves art school. Her falling in love with Kurt, who is a writer for one of the, like, a left-wing anti-fascist
newspaper magazine,
as well as her then love affair with one of her classmates that she had from art school, who was a woman.
Anna,
that's her name, yes. So in this course of 3 years, you see Marte develop as a person so much, and she finds so much freedom in Berlin, mm-hmm. and in the city itself, and like just the people that she's surrounded by when she's walking down the city, as well as kind of in the nightlife. So it's just like it's interesting to think of how in the Weimar Republic you had the situation where like it was very progressive, and like there was like a huge amount of freedom for women, for people of color, for
queer folks.
For queer folks, there was a huge increase of freedom, while at the same time there was these, you know, battles in the streets between the communists and the brown shirts, the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that what you're also seeing in Berlin is like you have Marta, and then you also have the experiences of all the other characters. So there's Marta's a middle class background and coming to art school, and then there's also working class characters that you get to see. And there's, you know, one family in particular that's sort of divided between communism and the Nazis as like, and the brown shirts as like the two sort of responses to the struggles that they're facing and to the deprivation and poverty that they face. It's like, are you going to go with the communists or are you going to go with the fascists? But like all of it is happening in this feeling of great change, like major transformations feel like they're happening around people. And just the way the art is drawn to sort of show the like the intense bustle of Berlin. You know, this is a huge city. It's a capital. It's like dynamic. And, you know, it's a rich history. And I don't know a lot of it. And there's all kinds of stuff that we're glossing over. But like, that dynamism to the place really comes across. And then like thinking about how in that dynamic of a place, such a like dangerous and also like nihilistic and anti-human kind of political movement can grow.
Yeah, like it's just interesting because there is so much hope in the book, right? Like in the character of Marte and the character of Gundran, who is the mother of the family. There is just like this large amount of enjoyment at life and like taking on new responsibilities and like the excitement that comes in the space that can come here.
But like none of that can alleviate the sort of the economic like crisis that Germany is in, mm-hmm. you know, post World War One and through the 20s, right? Like, despite all of this sort of dynamic changes that are happening, they're also happening in a context of like very, very, very intense inequalities and like intense economic crisis, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Republic is in an enormous amount of crisis, and
yeah,
like none of the sort of positive, hopeful things necessarily like alleviates that problem.
So yeah, there is kind of the search for hope in and amongst these problems that are seeking out. And it's also just like the pace at which it happens. Mm-hmm. Like it's set over 3 years, but both in terms of character development and in terms of like political events, it's a rapid, rapid pace set that it's just like, there's always a change. There's always a change in character. There's always a change in economic circumstances. There's always a change kind of, there's just so much movement mm-hmm. that happens in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the difference, I think, like in Family Lexicon, the story is very much, it's like a quieter story.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And even though like you can feel all the weight of the particular history that she's outlining, the story itself is very quiet, and it's very much about this, like you're saying, this like quirky family that has, the reason it's called Family Lexicon in part is because they're a family that have very particular word usage that is sort of internal to their family. And so a great deal of the humor of the book, and it is a really funny book in a way that Berlin is not funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's really funny because she's constantly talking about these different like words that they have for things. And they're words that we think have a particular meaning, but in their family, they can mean something very different. And her focus is very much on these people who are her immediate family. And one of the things that struck me and that I think is reflected in some of the writing I was reading about the book is that she talks about the big events more in passing, and that what's more important is talking about her experience of being in this family. Yeah. And her experience of who these people were. And like she herself isn't much of a character in the book. She's almost absent. As a narrator, but you really get this fleshed out view of like who her father is and who her mother is and like why and their motivations and their daily cares and also their political desires for like for Mussolini not to be in power. Like it's both their like daily concerns about shopping and making dresses or, you know, some of the stuff, I can't remember all the stuff her father is concerned with on a daily basis, but like there's those.
Wow, it's just to say his like hatred of every time one of them gets married.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Thinks that it's a terrible idea and it doesn't matter who it's to or like how old they are, if it's a daughter or a son, he thinks that it's a terrible idea for them to get married.
Yeah, and it's like they're just this quirky family, but they're also this like radically anti-fascist family that has very specific politics and like faces a lot of consequences. Like mm-hmm. the parents have to go into exile, and her brother ends up living in France because he's in exile. Mm-hmm. He has to run away from Italy, and like I said, she gets put in prison. Her husband gets put in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think for me, what we can compare in the books is the way in which they're telling different stories about where we can find resilience mm-hmm. in the face of fascism. And I think for Berlin, especially in the character of Martha, but in many of the other characters as well, the resilience comes in hope, and it comes in her willingness and openness to experience positive transformations and to maintain her hope
mm-hmm.
and to maintain her struggle. Right. And maybe less her, but there are other characters in the book who some of the communists who are sort of very much, you know, like their resilience comes in maintaining their struggle against the fascists. Whereas in Family Lexicon, I think the resilience comes in the sort of the continuity and the holding on to things that are continuous. Family Lexicon ends with like all of this dramatic stuff has happened. And then at the very end, it just ends with the parents coming back together and having one of their sort of classic humorous arguments. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not that everything has been set right and we've forgotten all the history. It's that their lexicon, their ways of being together, are they're able to hold on to those and use those to find strength.
Yeah. So it should be noted that family lexicon ends after World War II.
Yes.
So, like, it's like this family is shattered by World War II, but it comes together and is able to do that. So I think the other point on family lexicon that I quite liked is how, while all of this stuff is happening, their lexicon continues to grow. Like, their way of speaking and their way of stories continues to grow and develop. So they don't actually, like, in the face of fascism, they don't automatically just give up. They, like, actually find ways to adapt it and, like, add it as part of their resistance. So, like, part of it is, so after their son has to go to France for exile, the mother, she kind of just wanders around, just, and whenever she's with a group of people, she just wants her boring old life back. So when her husband gets out of prison, like, that's all she's just talking about, her wanting her boring old life back. And she's always excited when the other son, Alberto, he will come and he'll have these, like, fascism is at its end, and she will just be really, really happy and excited every single time he says that, even though, like, they kind of all know that he's just looking at his tarot cards and, like, gleaning this from his tarot cards.
Right.
So it's just, like, they're just these little stories of, like, yeah, like, that is also a little bit of a way of resistance for this family, is, like, is being able to continue on in it with their resistance, is to continue on and be their family and add into these stories and ways of speaking, and letting that, like, way of speaking meld kind of them together in their own resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, oh, these terrible things are happening, we have to give up who we are. But it's like, let's be who we are and, like, still resist things, but let's be who we are and be that resistance.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, I think that goes really easily into one of the things that I think is really, really powerful about what Natalia Ginzburg is doing with this book. Because I think both of us, we were reading it, and it's sort of like, I think our initial reaction was kind of like, I don't think this is the book we thought it was going to be. But because it didn't feel like it was enough of the anti-fascism piece. But then I think reading the essay that was written at the end of the book and thinking about it more, one of the things that really strikes me and that really sticks out about the book is her claiming of language. And that's really striking, the way that she wants to talk about how families claim language because of the role language plays in fascism and the role of colonizing and taking over language in order to control people and in order to control society. And I think part of what she's doing in the book is showing how her family had a language that fascism couldn't take from them. Mm-hmm. And that's part of their resistance and their resilience. And there's a really great, so there's this amazing passage that she writes at close to the end of the book, sort of after the war, after fascism has been defeated in Italy. She's talking about sort of her spheres and where people are going from this. And she writes, "Everyone thought he could, or rather should, write poetry about any and all subjects, since for so many years the world had been silenced and paralyzed, reality being something stuck behind glass, vitreous, crystalline, mute, and immobile. Novelists and poets had been starved of words during the fascist years. So many had been forbidden to use words, and the few who'd been able to use them were forced to choose them very carefully from the slim pickings that remained. During fascism, poets found themselves expressing only an arid, shut-off, cryptic dream world. Now, once more, many words were in circulation, and reality appeared to be at everyone's fingertips. So those who had been starved dedicated themselves to harvesting the words with delight, and the harvest was ubiquitous because everyone wanted to take part in it."
I really, like, I love that quote, and I love that part of the book, because it reflected sort of, like, how alive people felt after fascism, after the war. But it's also kind of like you were just saying, like, of how important our words are and how important what we say is and how important what we continue to say is, like what we're talking about as well. Because fascism wants to limit what we can say. It wants to limit what we can talk about and how we say it. And, like, so it does that, obviously, like, in, like, the fascist governments of, like, of Italy and Germany, of, like, actually, like, clamping down on what can be published. But I think when we think about it in our current context, you see these attempts to silence ideas of liberation, silence ideas of queerness, of trans, of racial justice as, you know, like, and trying to do that in a way that, like, they try to do that in a way that clamps, like, oh, this is just my free speech, where it's just like, no, you are trying to actually stop people talking about their own life. Mm-hmm. And their own living. And it's just like, we need to remember that we can't just let that win. And we need to find different ways of doing it. I think we need to find, like, all of the ways of doing it, just because it's just so important. Like we can't let them not necessarily frame the debate, but frame how we feel.
You're phrasing it. Because it makes me think about sort of what's happening right now in the free speech, the way that sort of fascism is mobilizing this language of free speech. And then, mm-hmm. you know, people, so, like, not everyone who's talking about free speech is necessarily a fascist, but there's something fascistic about the way that free speech is being mobilized to certain ends. And I'm thinking about, like, the way that people are just like, oh, we need to debate whether or not we use people's pronouns. We use the pronouns that people identify with and want us to use, as if that's some kind of debate, and as if they're having some sort of, like, debate over a reasonable disagreement, and rather than, like, what you're actually doing and what trans folks have been showing us is, like, what you're doing is denying humanity, and you're denying people the words to express their humanity and to express their feelings of who they are. And yeah, it's really important to continue saying, like, that is what they're doing, and that is what we reject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just, like, finding the different forms to do that as well. Mm. Because I think it's, like, again, if it's just, like, we're doing this in sort of, like, the debate or the essay format, which is great, and there should be one, but it also limits our own imagination and our own feelings, that, like, we need people to, like, write poetry, even if, like, we might, you know, like, I think it can come off that people who do that, they're not engaging in real politics. It's a general theme of our podcast, right, of the ways in which what people are seeing as real politic or real resistance. But I think what that passage kind of points out and draws out for us is that all of this can be resistance. And, like, mm-hmm. and for us to live full lives, like, we need that. We need to feel that sort of, like, rush of freedom that comes with engaging in all sorts of creative and artistic processes that engage in who we are as mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about the way resilience comes up in Berlin, and particularly around, like, Marta's story and Kurt's story, I guess.
Yeah. No, and I think it, and, you know, as we were talking about transitions, I think, like, or segues, this actually is a pretty close to a good segue. So Marta's first lover is Kurt. And, like I said, he was a writer editor at a leftist anti-fascist magazine. He is very militant in his anti-fascism. He is horrified by what the Nazis are doing. Very, very, very critical of it. However, he ends up falling into a very, very deep depression mm-hmm. where, like, he pushes Marta away. He gives up writing. He's just unable to really do anything because he is so horrified by what he's seeing, by what he's seeing, and like what's happening with the Nazis. Like, he's unable to make any decisions, and he falls into like a pit of nihilist despair about what's happening. And I mean, like, I think his story is interesting because I can see how it happens, right? Like, I think, like, that's the pit that I know I've fallen in the last year. It just feels hopeless, right? Like, it just feels absolutely, completely, and utterly hopeless.
Well, so, like, part of his despair is certainly coming from his, like, hopelessness at what's happening, and, like, his, like, rage at the Nazis and at what fascism is looking like. But he's also, like, he's also not very willing to kind of participate in any of the contemporary responses to that fascism. So, like, he is encouraged continuously through the book to join with the communists and to work with fellow reporters who are now being, like, explicitly part of the Communist Party. And he refuses, and then at the moment that he even tries, like, going to one of their meetings, like, he's also horrified by them. And it's like he's unable to build a community in which to share the load of the grief and despair that fascism brings for us, which I think is, like, a really important lesson.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to, like, talk about it. Because he isolates himself. Mm-hmm. And it's not like there aren't other people, right? Like, so, like, yes, a lot of the reporters do end up joining the Communist Party, but, like, not all of them do. Mm-hmm. Some of them do remain independent, and, like, they keep trying to, like, bring people together, and people do try to bring him out of it and take care of him, but he is just so resistant to it. And largely because, again, like you think you're saying, like, he refuses that assistance and he doesn't want it. It's just, he falls, like, I can't describe it any other than, like, just falls into the nihilistic despair where it's just, like, nothing is able to bring him out.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would see it as, like, it's not just him falling. Like, he's actively choosing to refuse community. He actively is choosing to refuse people, like, people participating with him or, like, feeling things with him. And, like, one of the things that I wrote down and that really struck me is that moment when he really yells at Marta. It's, like, one of those turning point moments in their relationship where he just, like, he gets very angry with her and, like, to the point of, like, this is violence. Like, this is a violent outrage reaction. Yeah. And it's like, there is a line that happens between, like, despair and masculinity and despair and, like, domestic violence. And, like, also thinking about, like, then Martha becomes, like, she leaves him and goes and has a relationship with Anna. And she gets a lot from that relationship. And she, like, finds a lot about herself through that. And yet she also then goes back to Kurt and takes care of him and, like, does all of this emotional labor for him. Yeah. And it's like, I think that there's a message that's also being sent there about, like, masculinity inhibits our ability to find community. Mm-hmm. And that's a really crucial thing to undo in the context of rising fascism, because we can't afford a bunch of depressed dudes, like, lying around waiting for women to come take care of them.
No, like, I think you're right. Like, I think it is interesting how much Marte really, really cares for Kurt, and how constantly willing she is to do this work for him and to get him up off his feet. And, I mean, this isn't to, like, he also has his friend from the paper who also does this work. Mm-hmm. But, like, Marte, I think, is the one who really is able to draw him out and, like, get him up and going. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it is. I think it is interesting to think of, like, if we are looking at saying, like, okay, community building is an important aspect that we need to look at in order to fight, to build our own resiliency and the fight against the far right and fascist movements. Then, like, I mean, it's a question for all organizing. Like, how do you combat what, like, the toxic, certain toxic behaviors of masculinity are? Mm-hmm. And how do you stop that from happening? How do you push them out and transform them into being something that can be, I know I don't like to use the word productive, but like maybe useful, or at the very least not harmful to like trying to build community and trying to fight for something greater.
Yeah, that's a big question.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think it's one that Berlin necessarily gets us to.
Mm-hmm. I think we're in a place and in a time where, I don't know, like those questions, I mean, I'm sure that those questions, had they been posed in those terms, probably wouldn't have made a whole lot of sense in the 1930s.
No.
But like, I'm sure that those were things that, if they had been able to be addressed, could have been productive in that context. But like, I just feel like in our current context, I mean, we've talked about this in our discussions around climate change, right? Like there's all of these other pressures that are happening in conjunction with the kind of economic collapse that is pushing people to support fascism. Yeah, I don't know. It's just really hard because I think that's a really important question. And it doesn't have an answer in this space, but like it needs to be asked, I think, in all spaces.
Do you think the author of Berlin is making Marta out to be naive and unaware of the dangers that are being faced?
Ooh.
So I asked this question in the sense that like, so there's a scene after Kurt has fallen into his depression where him and Marta go for a walk along the river. And Kurt, like, explains why he is so depressed and so, like, horrified. And just asks Marta, like, well, what do you see? Like, what do you see? And her response is, like, look around us. It's always been here before. Like, look at the trees, look at the water, look at the things. It's like, it's always been here before us and it'll be here after us. And, like, kind of through that sort of thinking, she finds hope and she is able to like move on. So do you think that he is making her out to be naive?
No, I don't think so. Because I think there's a couple things that I think. I think Marta is showing us the work that people who are able to find resilience and able to find communities do to locate the things that bring them joy. Right? Like I've heard in organizing that I've been involved in recently, there's been a lot of talk about joy, right? Mm-hmm. And like the necessity of finding joyful spaces and finding ways of building that into the work that we do. And it's going to look different than what it looks like for a woman, a middle-class woman in 1920s, 30s Berlin. Like what brings us joy is going to look different and how we articulate that is going to look different. But I think that that's what she's doing. But then I think the second piece of that, which is equally as important, is to talk about class, right? And to talk about like Marta is not in an uncomfortable class position, right? And she does have an awkward relationship to her family, and it does end up creating the situation where she has to leave Berlin at the end of the book. But at the same time, she's also not in the situation that like Gundren's daughter, Sylvie, is in, who is literally like, she's orphaned and ejected out of society and like has to kind of make her way and then only is able to like survive because somebody sort of like takes her under his wing and like, and protects her because she's like 12,
yeah,
and orphaned after May Day because her to explain like her mother Gundren is a part of the Communist Party. Well, she goes with the Communist Party at May Day and she gets killed in the violent clashes that happen with police. So like, is Marta naive? No, but then at the same time she's also not like she's not the only voice. Like she's not the only. She's not the only experience of what's happening that we should be looking at. We should also be looking at what happens to Sylvie and think about like what that's going to look like for somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like, I think to answer kind of the way I think it was trying to think it through was, I don't think Marta is naive. Like she goes with Kurt and she like draws the portraits of the people that he's interviewing for like the May 1st after the May 1st massacre. So, like, she's well aware of all of the things that are happening around it. But it's like, yeah, because she has some privilege that she is able to not have it consume her life.
Mm.
And I mean, and I think it's just, and it's complicated, right? Because you're right, Sylvie is the answer, where it's like, because of her class position, right now, fighting with the communists is life and death for her. Mm-hmm. If she doesn't do that, she would probably end up dying on the street. Right? So it's, so there's hers, but then it's just like, yeah, where it's just like, and then you have with Kurt, where like, he gets all consumed by it, right? Like, where it's just like, he wants to be the doodly guy who, like, he himself was going to defeat the Nazis.
Yeah.
Right? So, and because, like, obviously no one person can defeat the Nazis, that, like, he falls into the despair, these different ways to interact, and, like, the ways in which kind of, like, our own positions kind of leads us to the way in which we interact with things.
Yeah, but I think that there's also sort of two points in there where we're being shown, like, moments where, like, an intervention is needed in order to build, like, an actual, in order to build movements, in order to build resistance. And the first is an intervention on Kurt's doodliness and a transformation of those toxic things about him into something that's actually about joyful community and about, like, actual collective resistance. And then there's also, like, Marta and Sylvie meet, right? In that one moment, during close to the end of the book, Sylvie mugs Marta.
Yes, that's right.
Right? So Marta's sitting on a park bench and Sylvie comes up and demands money from her. And then I don't think Marta has any money. And so it's like she demands, like, whatever's in her bag from her. And Marta is very scared by this and she's sort of very shaken by it. And Sylvie kind of lashes out at her and lashes out at her class position and her relative privilege to, like, the suffering that Sylvie is experiencing. And it's like, in that moment, it's like, those two people need to find a place to meet, right? We need to build the capacity for those two people, those two experiences to meet and to work together and to be in solidarity. And we need to, like, get Kurt's toxicity out of that. And it's like, I think that there's a lot there to think about it, about how, like, how we approach movement building, or, like, it's not just we each have in, like, different experiences of the rise of fascism. It's like there are moments when meetings can happen and when, like, connections can get made. And, you know, I'm as guilty of this as the next person. Like, we miss so many of them. Yeah, so many moments get missed.
But it's also like, I don't know, I think it's, because you're right about the missing of the moment, but it's also like Marta also misses the other moment when the burlesque that they're in is raided.
Yes.
Right? So the burlesque is raided, bunch of people are arrested, including Anna, because she dresses as a man, so they arrested her for being a gay man.
It's unclear, we should also clarify, it's unclear whether Anna would identify as transgender if that language was available to her.
Yeah. Probably they would, because she wants to be identified as Herr, not woman of, in German, what is?
Frau.
Frau, yeah. She prefers to be identified as Herr instead of Frau. And Marta is just kind of flippant about it. Like, she is really dismissive of the arrests, of the attack by the police, of Anna's experience in prison. And, yeah, like, she almost sees it as, I don't know, maybe not a joke, but, like, she's just dismissive of the seriousness of what had just happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, yeah, like, you're right. Like, and I think that's part of, like, the protection that she has of being able to just leave Berlin, like if she needed to.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I just, yeah, so it's just like she just misses that connection. So she's close, but she's just not quite there.
But and it also speaks to, like, how more broadly missing the significance of certain events in, like, the train of how we get to a certain place. Because as is explained in Berlin, like, the arrests, the raids that were held against queer spaces, burlesques, queer bars and stuff in Berlin was a key point in the transformation towards like National Socialism, right? Like it was a key point along the path towards fascism, but it doesn't necessarily look like that in the moment in time, or doesn't look like that necessarily to the people who experience it, but like Martha, don't have to experience the full force of it because she isn't out the way that Anna is out.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of moments like that that we miss. I know that there are moments that I have missed that in the past, you know, few years, we're looking back on it now, and you're just like, holy shit, that was actually a stepping stone for that. I mean, like everybody thought that, well, not everybody, but there was a large group of people who saw Jordan Peterson, this like totally unknown professor from the University of Toronto, well, not totally unknown, but like publicly unknown, come out against being told that you should respect somebody's pronouns. And people were like, why the fuck does this matter? Why are we spending so much time on this? And he, it turns out, is like the like a global leader in like thinking towards like in fascist thinking.
Yeah.
And there were people at the time who were telling us, this is a big deal. Yeah. This is a big deal and you should pay attention to this. You should pay attention to Lindsay Shepherd. You should pay attention to these people. And a lot of people, myself included, didn't want to pay that attention.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like, there's a lot of parallels where it's like, these things don't necessarily look, if we're not experiencing the full force of them, they don't necessarily look enough like a problem. And that's a problem, right? Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, needing to learn and to learn to recognize where the problems are.
Mm-hmm.
So for the sake of time, we ended up cutting the much longer conversation we had about fascism in our current moment and how to relate it to what happened in the 1930s. But we have included some links to resources in the episode description.
One of the things to take it back to the books, it's just like these books are really good. And I think they did a lot kind of like helping us, like, or at least helping me sort of like think through like, okay, like how should I be feeling?
Mm.
But don't necessarily give me the political tools to understand the contemporary moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to look elsewhere for that.
Yeah. But it's a good recall to like bring us back to the question of feelings and like what we're actually, like what we're able to unpack when we read books like this and think about in terms of, in terms of feelings and in terms of building communities where That's we can exactly feel it. Together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Build our own language.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I think that's everything. And this is our last book-based episode for the year. We have one more episode coming up, which is going to be our year in review, where we just talk about all the books we read this year. But thank you very much for listening. And if you have any comments that you'd like to share with us, you can drop us a message on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're able to make a rating or write a review on whatever app you're using to listen to the podcast. That would be really fantastic.
Yeah. So as we're looking into 2020, if there are any books that have really drawn you out that you've taken a lot of inspiration from that you think we could talk about, let us know what they are.
Yeah.
Because we are looking for next year.
Yep. All right. And catch you next time.
Cheers.
Music for this podcast is by Ketza from their album Metamorphosis. You can find them at the Free Music Archive or at ketzamusic.com. Do we need to start all over again? Because we are 2.5 minutes in. Kind of banter that leads to productive podcast making, and you know it. All right. It's going to get cold in here soon. Come on.
I don't know. I listen to a lot of Snap. Sometimes there's a lot of them at This American Life. They're pretty silly. entering it.
We are not Ira Glass.
He's the worst.
He is the worst. No, Jesse Brown is the fucking worst. I'm keeping that part in the podcast. Okay.
Okay, 9 o'clock is coming soon.